In this episode of Dear Analyst, I'm going to be talking about a blog post called Show Me the Data that was on the Tableau blog on April 17th, 2019 by Barry Chaiken, MD, who is a clinical lead for the healthcare team on Tableau. Now, for those of you who don't know, if you have ever played around with data visualization, chances are you've come across Tableau at some point or the other. They're kind of a big deal in the data visualization space, definitely an awesome platform. I've used them in the past. And this blog post, this episode will be more about the blog post itself, not necessarily about getting into the weeds of Excel, but I think a lot of the learnings from this blog post were really interesting to me. And I'll just quickly walk through what the blog post is and then kind of my takeaways and feedback was from this blog post. And so the author, Barry, goes on in this blog post to talk about how physicians they pride themselves on their ability to think through problems critically. And he gives three rules for presenting analytics to physicians to make sure that the data is actionable for the physician. So the first thing he says is, you must carefully curate data sources and make sure they are clean, accurate, and appropriately represent the metrics presented in the delivered analytics. Most healthcare data sources are dirty, require removal of duplicates, so on and so forth. And this is, I think, really the job of any data science person is, or any analyst for that matter, is to just make sure the data is clean and accurate. It doesn't matter if you're working for a physician's office in a hospital or for just any kind of business, having clean, properly formatted data is like a first step. So I think this is kind of not just applying to physicians, but really any company. The data sources themselves could be anything as well, but it's really your job as the analyst or the data scientist to make sure that the data is clean and accurate. The next rule is something that I thought was definitely more important, not only for businesses, but more importantly for physicians. He says, ensure the basic statistical principles, such as sample size, are considered when presenting results. Now, this is important in business because you don't want a situation where obviously the sample size is small and therefore you make a decision based on a small sample size, but it could be a false positive. That's like probably the worst case scenario where you're investing millions and millions of dollars on a sample size that's too small, but because the sample size told you to do A instead of B, you decide to go with that because it's all the data you have. So in business, that's definitely not great. It could lose to net loss or something and affect the bottom line. But for physicians, this is probably a huge big deal because if you present a sample size that's too small and you're saying that the patient should take medicine A over medicine B, that could probably have real drastic effects. And so when the result is life and death, you better be sure that the data has a strong statistical significance. Otherwise, you're essentially leading a patient to take some drug that's not meant for them. And so as simple as this may sound, having a basic, as simple as this basic stat principle sounds, I think in the physicians and in the medical world, it's multiplied by 10x because of the what's on the line, which is potentially a patient's life. So I think if you treat your use case of data and your use case of using sample sizes as seriously as what you would do for a physician, then I think your business will be in a lot better shape. Of course, you have to deal with time and the resources to collect the bigger sample size, but I think there's so much more rigor in the medical field that you really can't go around getting a strong statistical sample size. Otherwise, like I said, the results could be fatal. And finally, I think the third point is also applies to any business. Deliver timely, actionable results so that physicians can take steps to improve care delivery. And obviously, that makes sense for physicians. You want to make sure that they have the right information to act upon in a timely manner, but that also applies to any business decision, whether or not to make an investment, whether or not to create a new product line. Without having that timely, actionable result, it's really hard for business owners to actually take those steps effectively. And one thing that, so my takeaway from this article is that data inside a hospital in any kind of medical field is probably much, I mean, it is much analyzed with much more rigor, and probably more people are skeptical of the data because of how drastic of an impact data can have if it doesn't deliver the right results, because then you're again administering the wrong drugs or the right drugs to people. And so I wonder how important it is for analysts to know that there are actual consequences to delivering the wrong data or the wrong results. And to create that kind of culture, and the author in the blog post talks about how do you create this culture around the data. And I think I see this in my organization myself and other organizations where there's not enough trust for the data science or data analytics. But to build that trust, I think these three steps really help with that. And nowhere is that trust needed than in the medical and physicians world, because without building that trust that the data is correct, without trusting that your data scientists can provide that timely and accurate data with a statistically significant sample size, then you're basically putting patients' lives in danger. So just as kind of like a key takeaway is that your ability to clean data, to provide statistical significance, and to provide actionable results should be the top three things that you do in your job. Even though there may not be people's lives on the line, but when you are in a role where people's lives are on the line, I think by just nature of the business and probably by the law, you definitely want to build trust with the physicians and with your business stakeholders and your business partners. Otherwise, bad things can happen. So I think this was an interesting blog post because it talks about the intersection between people trusting other people in terms of physicians trusting the analysts, and with just being a good analyst yourself in terms of cleaning the data, delivering the data, so on and so forth. So yeah, just a short little takeaway feedback on this blog post which I came across. And now I'm going to get into other episodes that I came across in the last few weeks that I thought were really interesting. And the first one actually is kind of unrelated to data and analysis, but that's what I love about this part of the episode is that I can talk about whatever I want. And this was an episode from the Inside Intercom podcast, and it is, I think, part of a new series that they have called Scale, and it's the third episode in the series. And the title is What Makes a World-Class CMO in 2019 and the Number One Reason CMOs Fail. And this episode from Inside Intercom had the guest Heather Zinczak. I'm probably saying that wrong. Let me see. I forget what company she worked for. Let me just look really quick. She is the CMO at Pluralsight. And what I liked about this episode was that she talks about her path to becoming the CMO. I think she actually came from a technical role in her previous career and then kind of molded into a more marketing role. And what I liked about the episode was that she mentions how she used to think that a marketing a marketer's role was, you know, there wasn't a lot of analysis or a lot of kind of, rigor to how you use data to inform the role. But in reality, now that there's so many tools out there for marketers and salespeople to use, it is a very data-driven kind of role. And around minute 22, she talks about how her and her CRO are very closely, they have a really good relationship because what marketing does, the CRO is obviously in charge of the sales team and sales management, and how marketing interacts with sales has to be tightly coupled together. Now, previously, even when I was starting my career, I used to think that marketing was, you know, they handle all the nice, you know, fluffy, you know, brand kind of responsibilities. Sales is much more, you know, they're on the front lines, closing deals, meeting with customers, closing sales, getting customer feedback, and they were two separate departments. And today, that could be nowhere farther from the truth. As Heather talks about in the episode, what was really interesting is that her goals are, her team's goals are pretty much tied to the sales team. And so she says that at the top of the funnel, usually a marketing team is in charge of getting top of the funnel leads. This is coming top of the funnel leads, meaning you get potential customers coming from a webinar, from a live event, from an email blast. And those leads are typically what the marketer is setting goals against. You know, I have to generate 10,000 leads in this quarter, 10,000 leads in a month. But how many of those leads actually turn into opportunities for salespeople to actually close deals down in the funnel? And that disconnect is, I think, very common in many organizations. But I think what Heather talks about was that her marketing team's goals are basically how many opportunities does she create for salespeople. So her marketing team is not responsible for top of the funnel leads. They're responsible for what I've come to know as sales accepted leads, or SALs. And in order for that lead to become a sales accepted lead, the salesperson has to say to the marketing team, okay, you got this lead through some webinar, through some event. Now I'm going to qualify them to make sure that they are a potential opportunity for my team and I to close and turn into a win down the line. And overall, I really like this part of the episode because I recently built a template around B2B marketing, and I looked at every single stage of the funnel and understood how leads come in at the very top and then go all the way to the bottom to a closed deal. And marketing and sales have to work really closely together to make sure that that funnel is seamless. And of course, there's going to be different conversion rates between top of the funnel marketing lead to the sales accepted lead to a sales qualified lead to a closed win. But I think this was an interesting case where you have the marketing team's goals aligned with the sales team's goals, and now you just have kind of like one team, one dream kind of thing working together. And so, yeah, this was, I think another way to take away, at least from the analytical perspective, is now you can really quantify the marketer's contribution to the business, because typically the marketer is doing events and creating social media marketing, but how many of those potential impressions or leads turn into opportunities for the sales team to close? And I think the more metrics you can have around the fluffy kind of marketing initiatives, the better it is for your team, for your sales team, and the better it is for your bottom line. So high level, great episode, quantify the marketing team's efforts. And again, it was really top of mind for me because I had just built out this template model for B2B marketers. All right, the next episode is from another one of my favorite podcasts called The Changelog. And the episode was called Why Smart Engineers Write Bad Code. And I'm not an engineer. I've written a little code in my past, so some of the concepts in this episode were a little foreign to me. But I think one of the key takeaways I had was around minute 31 when the interviewer was talking with Adam Barr, who worked at Microsoft. And the question, obviously, that the interviewer asked Adam was, why smart engineers write bad code? And Adam first goes on to talk about what's considered quote-unquote good code, which is you are working on a class project in school, maybe you're studying computer science, and you're looking at a piece of bad code. And the way that you make the code good is to make it run faster. So from a perspective of performance, code is considered good when it runs fast, and people even say, oh wow, that was a really clever way that you made that loop run faster or remove lines of code to make it more efficient and, you know, using less memory. But in practice, he was saying that is not what matters in the real world. In the real world, he was saying that being able to make the code run faster doesn't really matter. What matters is the longevity of the code, the maintainability, the ability for it to be readable. And from that perspective, it's really difficult to describe what is good code. And again, I haven't contributed code to an organization and understand the full kind of complexities of that, but at least in my small little world of Excel files and Excel analysis, and you probably have experienced this as well in your point of view, is when you have an Excel file that you've optimized down to a T, it's a really small Excel file, the macros run perfectly, the formulas are written perfectly, but then when it actually gets used in the wild by your team or by some business partner, they start doing things to the code, to the model that it wasn't meant to do. No matter how many rules you put in an Excel file saying, don't touch this formula or don't put any data in this part of the Excel file, they'll still do it. They'll write all these random formulas. They'll change formulas around. And before you know it, it's involved into this object that you can't really maintain. But let's say you are in charge of fixing it up later down the stream, and you have to basically understand what all the new changes and features that the people in your team want to have. And now you have to build that into your original well-run machine that was this perfect, you know, macros and formulas are written perfectly, and now you have to rewrite all this stuff to make it run in a different way. And to me, that was kind of like the analogy that I drew from this episode, in that how do you make it so that it's readable, maintainable, that it's just anyone can use it and it's not hard to update. I've worked on projects in the past in an Excel files where I'm basically inheriting someone's really crappy Excel file that they thought ran really well at one point in time, but they didn't really think about how it could be applied for, how it could account for future scenarios. Like, for instance, there's one file I remember working on where there was exactly 10 data validation cells, so 10 dropdowns, and the person didn't account for, well, what if you wanted to add more values to a specific dropdown? That person just hard-coded the values that load up in that dropdown and didn't think about, what if the person wants to add in 5 more values or 10 more values? They should have made that reference a dynamic range. And so those were examples of, I mean, I'm maybe going on a tangent here, but I think when it comes to how an engineer can write good code or bad code, or how an Excel analyst can write good and bad Excel formulas, there are kind of many similarities there. And this episode definitely goes into some of the nitty-gritty about how you can be a really great analyst and a really great engineer, but still write bad code or bad quote-unquote formulas. So definitely give that episode a listen. That concludes this episode. If you have any feedback, we'd love to hear it. Otherwise, I will talk to you guys on the next episode.